Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. She's the real deal. Right now, she's hotter than the equator. A stellar singer of rare depth and intuition. Just some of the glowing reviews written about pop jazz singer-songwriter Gabrielle Stravelli, who happens to be my guest today. Gabrielle began performing as a soloist with orchestras when she was 15, and in the years since has appeared at Feinstein's 54 Below, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, Birdland, the Hammerstein Ballroom, all here in Manhattan. She toured the U.S. with Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, appeared as a soloist with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra and the Cincinnati Pops, was also part of the State Department's American Music Abroad program, singing in, of all places, Azerbaijan, Moldova, Slovenia, and Malta. Gabrielle's got a very busy 2017. A dream ago, her first major collection of original songs was released in January, and her national tour is up and running. So there's a lot to talk about. Let's meet and get to know Gabrielle. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Gabrielle, music in your soul? Always knew you'd sing?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing that it happened that way. I always sang. I always loved music. I played French horn and piano when I was a kid. But there are no musicians in my family. My sister has a beautiful voice, but never pursued singing, you know, on a professional level. But my parents aren't musicians. I don't have any relatives who sing or play music. So it's really...
Well, you know what's weird? I mean, I sang at home too, but, you know, no one was banging down my door to do anything with. I mean, how did you know that you were your voice in a sense?
Well, I can answer that in two ways. One is that I do know that in second grade, the music teacher sort of just led this general music choir class, Mrs. Campanella, went to my mom and said, Gabrielle has a really good voice. You should get her into community theater.
Okay.
And my mom, you know, she sort of suggested that, you know, to just sort of see if I really liked doing it in a more serious structure.
Well, community theater as being in musicals?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I always sang. I mean, I can remember sort of like being in the back seat of the car on car rides and just
singing along with the radio?
Oh, just like making up my own songs. So I'm sure that was very annoying for my siblings that I was like always and I remember kids in grammar school complaining that, like, when it was that time in class when you're supposed to be doing your own work.
Quiet they
would
time.
Say, yes, Gabrielle is singing. And I didn't even realize I was doing it. Mm-hmm. So.
Boy, would they regret it now when they can't get into your shows or whatever.
That's right.
I showed them.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So you play the French horn and the piano and you get older. And then it starts to even sink into your head more so that, wait, we've got something here.
I think I just loved it so completely. It's like singing is my happy place. Mm-hmm. Music is my happy place. And I think I always felt that. And I was lucky. I had parents who never said, go
Stop.
Be a doctor, yeah. be a, you know, get a real job.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that I loved it. And so they said, go for it.
And so you actually did pursue community theater throughout
your
younger years?
Yeah, we did community theater. Music lessons, and then I decided to go to a conservatory for college, and that was kind of that really felt like a big decision.
Yeah, yeah, but before we get to college and a big decision, as I mentioned in the introduction, you were 15 when you were performing as a soloist with orchestras. Let's not get to college yet. How did that happen?
That fell into my lap, and it's so funny because my mom is the opposite of a stage mom. She never pushed.
Mm-hmm.
She just didn't want to do that. Because we were around a lot of stage parents in community and regional
I'm
theater,
sure.
And that was not her thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happened, if I recall correctly. Someone asked me to sing with an army band, like a local army band, just to sing the Star Spangled
Banner. Okay.
At a concert. And it happened that there was this man, he's a priest, Father Alphonse. He's still out there working today and ministering. He had this interesting career in which he, I guess he was a chaplain for many years. He's a priest, but he's a conductor by trade or whichever or vice versa. And he was conducting the band that day that I sang the Star Spangled Banner. And he also happened to be the conductor of this Orchestra of St. Peter by the Sea. They used to do summer concerts on the Jersey Shore.
That's ringing a bell for me.
When I was a teenager, when I was in high school, and he heard me that day, and he said, you should come sing with the orchestra. You should do some of the summer concerts. And in a way, like, it was great that my parents didn't know any better, you know, because maybe some, we'd have been like, you know, said, oh, she's not ready for that or whatever. But we were like, sure, that sounds wonderful and exciting.
Was it a natural act for you when you did that?
Yes and no. I mean, I got, you know, nervous beforehand. It mm-hmm. wasn't like...
Well, the Star Spangled Banner ain't no easy tune
it's
to
not.
Belt out.
And when you're 15 and, like, singing with a 42-piece orchestra, it's a lot. But I do remember I would get very nervous beforehand. I'm a little bit still like this. I hate the waiting ahead of time. Mm. Once I'm on stage...
You're good. Yeah. I get that anticipatory stuff would be crazy.
So
that had to give you street cred as well as other people, you know? I mean, that's
I
a big thing
so.
To have under your belt.
I never thought of it
42 piece
that
orchestra
way.
You know, it's one thing to say let's put on a show and you know in the barn in the backyard, but to sing, you know, with a 42 piece orchestra. So then you went to a conservatory for college, and yeah. that's is that kind of more where you started to hone your craft, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a big decision because my parents really made sure that I focused on academics in high school. Mm-hmm. There was like a performing arts magnet high school, and I didn't go to that because they had a feeling I was going to pursue music
down the road.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted
so get a
me
good
to
education.
Have a good foundation
yeah,
for that. I applied to some liberal arts colleges to pursue a degree in linguistics.
Okay.
And I applied to some conservatories.
And you got into?
And I got into the Cincinnati Conservatory, and we went to and it had a really good reputation. And then my parents took me to visit, and, you know, it's this incredible campus, these beautiful facilities, and it's really, you know, kind of an amazing program. And so I just took a leap of faith and decided that I would really focus on music in college.
And it worked for you.
Yes and no.
Okay. Well, has it been a tough road to hoe?
No, it's that. I mean, I think conservatories are insane in some ways. Like, I just think Cincinnati in particular, I don't know if it is now, but it was a very intense, very competitive environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I was ready for that.
Yeah. And how do you get ready for something? Unless you're so driven, you
right.
know, if you're, you know,
right.
like the Mama Rose.
Exactly.
Office, you know.
And I was not that kid.
Right.
So it was a mixed bag in a lot of ways.
But it still gave you joy to sing.
Can I be honest?
No, don't tell me the truth.
I definitely burned out in a way while I was there.
Okay. Was it a four-year program?
It was a four-year program.
And you just thought, what have I done?
Kind of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not that it was all bad. Uh-huh. I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. I met my friends who are my best friends today, my family. I met, you know, had some amazing professors. And then on the other hand, I acquired a lot of neuroses that I did not have going in there.
Yes.
I sort of stopped trusting my instincts.
I was just going to say self-doubt.
Yeah,
absolutely. What a terrible
thing. You know,
yeah.
And that really soured me on performing and singing after mm-hmm. I got out for a few years. Mm-hmm. I kind of like had lost that joy that I had always had.
So whatever singing you were doing in those years after school was just for you, was just something
yeah,
personal.
I was uh-huh. like not really focused. And now looking back on it, I'm glad that I let myself live my life and drift around and be in New York and work day jobs.
So what turned it around? When did you say, I've got to do this?
And I kept singing, but like you said, it was really just for me. Because
mm-hmm.
I knew that I still loved singing, but I had all this other mission surrounding it. So in 2005, I got a call to go audition for this European tour of Hair. I remember it being the end of the year, and I almost blew it off. That's how I was at that time. But I went, and I remember I sang, and maybe they taught me a little dance routine, and then they asked me to step out of the room. And a couple minutes later, they asked me back inside the room, and they said, can you leave in 5 days?
Wow. Well, considering you probably had nothing else going on.
I didn't.
I'll get back to you, but you knew the answer
right,
was sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was kind of, I mean, that seems so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember calling my dad and telling him, and he said, go.
Where were you going?
We were going to Amsterdam. We were starting. It was
a
tour of Holland, primarily Holland, Germany, and Belgium. And I'm so glad I went.
So that kind of turned it around for you, huh?
Yeah. I fell back in love with performing, with singing. I remembered that I was really good at it. I like found my confidence in myself through performing and also through traveling and sort of having...
And being exposed?
Yeah, being exposed to different cultures and sort of seeing that like, oh yeah, like I can roll with, I can go to Rome and do as the Romans do, you know? Because I saw other people in the cast sort of digging their heels in and wanting things to be the way they were at home.
And, so you had the
flexibility. And that's okay. And that's okay. I get that. But for me... I was ready at that moment, and some whatever powers that be, I think, sent me this experience that, like, totally...
Impacted you.
Yeah. I mean, it was... I know it sounds corny, but...
No.
It really was, a turned things around for me in such a beautiful way.
But what's interesting about your story is, in terms of hair, that's musical theater.
Right.
And that's one avenue of performance. That's not... what you do.
No, but in some ways it was the perfect show for what I do now because it's really loose. It's not a musical where it's like everything's got to be exactly the same way every time. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of room for leaving things open and in the moment and for it being a little bit different each time. And that was also the thing that I think was really good for me. And that got me back to trusting my instincts.
So you come back home and you now maybe are a little bit more centered or a little bit more focused, for lack of a better way to describe it. And you want to have a career, huh?
Yeah. And I continued to sort of to work in the theater. But I also then I started. I think I knew that maybe musical theater wasn't the one thing, one and only thing that I wanted to pursue. I've always been a little bit of a square peg in a round hole.
Okay.
And I knew that singing was really the main thing for me. So I just thought, you know, how can I pursue a career as a vocalist? And, you know, luckily I'm in New York and there's so much opportunity here. There are so many.
Well, did you get an agent right away?
No, I sought out a teacher, actually. I'd never really had a mentor before. And I ended up finding this woman, Nancy Murano, who is an amazing jazz vocalist and pianist and teacher, a true teacher. And I started studying privately with her and taking some group classes.
Why jazz? What did you know then?
My dad was a huge jazz head. You know, I had grown up like listening to Ella Fitzgerald. We knew all the songbook records. And
you felt this affinity or this connection that this could best fit you.
Yes.
Yeah, suited you. Yeah.
You know, I already loved it. I just hadn't realized that I could pursue it as a career. But in New York, you know, I think I saw that there were people doing it. So, yeah, I met Nancy and I started studying. And I just got more and more into the scene. And the great thing is I didn't cut ties with theater work. You know, I still know a lot of people in that world. And I really love sort of having this fluid career where I do a lot of different kinds of music. I find that really satisfying.
Yeah, that works. So when did it come to you that you wanted to write your own music? And for the uninitiated and the odd, you know, can you describe that process for people who just don't have that talent and just don't kind of get it? I mean, I guess for you, it became a natural act after you honed your craft.
Yeah.
And then you moved into the fact that I could do this as a performer.
You know, my mom is a journalist by trade. She's an editor now. And she always like took a red pen to our school papers and... got our writing skills up. And when I was a teenager, I definitely spent a lot of time reading poetry and writing bad, angsty poetry.
Whatever.
Some of which I still have, believe it or not.
Just hide it, that's all.
Yeah, totally. It's under the bed. And then my father passed away very unexpectedly in 2008. And I actually started writing songs then. Because it was this one, you know, really valuable outlet for me to sort of channel and process
Express
that whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
So these songs have actually sort of been in the pipeline for a while. For me, I generally, there are a couple of tunes on the album that I wrote by myself, music and lyrics, but I really love collaborating. The process is not a linear one for me. I didn't go to school for composition. I've had experiences, you know, God bless, like a deadline. You know, there were moments in the recording process when we were making the album where lyrics had to be finished. I had to have words to sing when we went into the studio. So I had to say, I'm going to block out 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. today and sit down and write these words.
Uh-huh.
Generally, my process is not necessarily that. It's a little looser than that. I find inspiration strikes it.
At funny times, yeah, well, unexpected times.
Yes, at unexpected times. And I work with a bassist, my bassist, Pat O'Leary.
Mm-hmm.
We collaborate a lot on the music. And then I have a colleague, Jason Robinson, who's a vocalist and teacher and a wonderful writer. And we collaborate on lyrics a lot of the time.
But Dream Ago is your original collection.
Yes.
But you've produced other CDs, Waiting in Vain,
yes,
for example.
We have.
Was that your debut record?
Yeah, but they were mostly covers on that record. There's one original on there, I think.
Covers means that?
So standards, you know, songs that other people have written.
Oh, maybe I knew that, or maybe I didn't. Well, whatever. So how long did it take you, for example, to get to Waiting in Vain? That was your debut album, to date myself.
No.
And that was well-received?
It was.
I mean, that's also kind of taking your clothes off, right?
Absolutely. And granted, I mean, the funny thing is this album, Dream Ago, I really took my clothes off because Dream Ago is the first album I've ever recorded in a studio, which is a totally different beast and in some ways is much more vulnerable.
As opposed to what?
As opposed to live recording.
And
Waiting
that's
in Vain was recorded live.
Okay, and so you're kind of unaware of that in a sense.
A little bit.
It's not as contrived.
It's not as, I mean, you're just not, you know, when you're in a studio, you are hearing everything in
such
a raw way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it can really lead to picking apart every little thing.
Sure.
You know, and you're freed from that a bit in live performance. Yeah, you're hearing yourself, but it's just rolling along.
Oh, I would think the comparison would be massive.
And you're also receiving that energy back from the audience.
Of course.
Which makes such a big difference in terms of the actual performance of each song.
So 2008 is when you said your dad died, but when was Waiting in Vain released?
Waiting in Vain was released in 2011.
Oh, after the fact.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting. And that, for all intents and purposes, it was your signature album.
Yes.
And up until that point, there was no in-studio recording.
No.
You were just doing shows all over the place, whether it was Moldova, you know, or Manhattan. How did that come about? How did you wind up singing at some of these really Tony places in Manhattan? I mean, clearly you had to get hooked up with an agent, right?
Well, no, that's the amazing thing also I find about, I mean, I have a manager now,
mm-hmm,
for the last 2 years or so. But, you know, when I was younger and people would say to me, it's who you know, I didn't understand how true that is.
How did that work for you then?
So it's really about hustling and going to jam sessions and going to open mics and really getting yourself out there.
You think that that's only for comedians,
you know,
but it's for singers too, to go to open mics.
People need
to
hear you. They need to know what you do. And you have to be prepared and do a great job and show up and present something.
But
you know,
to sing along with musicians you've never worked with.
But I love that, and I always have.
So that doesn't intimidate you?
No.
Okay.
That doesn't. That, for whatever reason, when I was a kid, that part never intimidated me.
So you're doing these open mics, and then you're getting some more street cred.
Yeah,
and
you're meeting people. You're meeting working musicians who can hire you. You're meeting people who are musical directors who can hire you, you know, so forth and so on. So to me, that's like the hustle is where it's at.
So, for example, appearing at Feinstein's, 54 Below, one of the preeminent clubs in New York City, you did that solo.
I did. I mean, after I had this very nice New York Times review come out in, 2014?
How come that's just not tattooed on your arm, for God's sake? you don't remember that.
2014 or 15. So, you know, that really legitimized me in a big way. And the Feinstein's run came out of out of that happening.
Yeah, I mean, in Wynton Marsalis, who is not small potatoes.
Well, that's another thing. I was at an open mic, and the choir director for that Wynton Marsalis project heard me at the open mic and offered me a job.
So much of this can be out of your control.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a Yiddish word for that, beshert, that yes. person was supposed to be there
yes.
and that night and hear you.
But you have to, you know, I'm always, when I meet younger musicians or when I do master classes, I'm like, you gotta get off the couch. The number one thing is get yourself out there and meet people.
But that's also easier said than done.
It is.
You can be a very good singer and you can communicate. It's one thing in a recording studio where it's safe. I mean, you're on a stage with your clothes off.
Yeah.
You know, that and that. But for you, apparently, those were all natural acts.
The working with musicians, you know, that I'm not familiar with never scared me. Being on stage and being and really exposing myself was something I had to work on in terms of really opening up
and being comfortable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is something that's definitely developed and has grown over the years.
So define yourself. I mean, I said jazz pop. I mean,
I think that's yeah, I mean, that is how I define myself.
There's that sultry, sexy, smoky kind of feel to that music, right? As opposed to out there belting out, you know.
Sure.
There's an intimacy with that
yeah.
kind of music
yeah.
that is, well, to me, very appealing.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you hope to communicate with in terms of Dream-A-Go? I understand that the title track references your dad.
Yeah.
What's the tie that binds those songs in the album?
Oh, my gosh. Maybe this is like sounds too general or something. In a way, I feel that the songs are bound together. It's very appropriate, I think, for this interview because I do feel they're sort of representative of the way that I move in the world as a woman. So there are songs about my relationship with my dad. There are songs about relationships, romantic relationships.
So these are extremely personal songs.
Yeah, they're really personal. I think there's a feminist viewpoint to quite a few of the songs.
Mm-hmm. This may seem like a ridiculous question, but what is the difference between what you write and what you feel from writing as opposed to a song that someone else wrote?
Oh, that's not a ridiculous question at all. I was just talking to somebody about this, that I feel a sense of ownership over this project that I haven't quite experienced before because it is my own material and it is exposing myself, you know, in a greater way because they're my words.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but I might not necessarily know from the title track what precipitated that song.
Mm-hmm.
I could feel maybe whatever angst, pain,
right.
you know.
And I think you, as a writer, sometimes you get super specific, but I think that's kind of great to hear you say that about Dream-A-Go, about the tune, because it's you also want to sort of write things that are big enough that even if you haven't experienced that exact same thing that I wrote about, you've had some loss.
You
or
can
some,
connect anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So out of 12 songs,
mm-hmm.
three of them are standards.
Yes.
How did you determine what to include? One of my favorites is It Might As Well Be Spring.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I wanted to include a couple of standards because it is a jazz album and interpreting standards, you know, is a part of this tradition.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. It Might As Well Be Spring. I think I chose that one because it's so well known. It's
mm-hmm.
it's been performed a lot of times, but I felt that we had sort of a different take on it. It's not only sexual, but I think there is a yearning and mm-hmm. and there's a lot of desire in that lyric.
Well, and that really comes across.
So,
and you own it.
Yeah.
You really do own it. To move away from this for just a second, do you work with the same band? When you're performing live, it's the same guys when you...
Most of the time.
On your tour.
It is. Although, you know, there's definitely... I mean, we're so spoiled here in New York. There's so many wonderful people.
Musicians, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I find that I learn different things from each person and I hear different things in songs that I know, you know, I hear something different, I learn something different from each different person that I play it with.
One of the greatest senses that I get from you is that there's no rigidity in who you are, whether personally or professionally, that there is this flexibility. Well, I don't always have to have Tom Smith on bass. And maybe that's unspoken language among musicians.
I think it is among many, many musicians. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's something great about working with people regularly because you develop a sort of shorthand with each other.
Oh, I'm sure.
You know, so there's definitely an advantage to each situation.
What do you prefer, the songwriting process, and then how do you feel after the song is written? Do people say, this is no good, or I can't connect? Has that ever happened? Or are you the
arbiter?
I'm
sure. No, I'm oh, meaning like a writing partner?
Right,
or,
right.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I like writing with Pat O'Leary and Jason Robinson. They are people who will be honest with me and say, like, this is not happening.
This isn't while working.
You got to go back to the drawing board.
You feel comfortable.
Yeah, I'm not saying that always. I mean, sometimes it's
there can
it
be trouble
smarts
in paradise,
a little,
you,
you know,
yeah,
to hear that. But I sometimes I'm not even open to it. But I'm generally willing to then, like, put it away
and
take
revisit
a step back.
Like,
yeah. I try.
We're running out of time, but what I wanted to know is, so what's kind of down the road for you?
I think I'm always trying to learn more tunes, more standard, because I do love that. And I love, like, taking the existing, I'm a Virgo, so I love structure. So there's, but I like to mess around with that structure as well. So when you are singing a song that's already been written, the structure is there for you. And then there's this wonderful thing of sort of finding the way you want to change the melody, you want to phrase it differently. What's the meaning for you specifically? What is your point of view in interpreting this lyric?
And I would also have to assume what works for you is the fact that you play an instrument.
It helps. I mean, it certainly helps. I don't play, like, in
no,
public.
No, but knowing the piano.
But, yes,
you know,
it really does.
It
yeah.
must make a huge difference.
It does.
I thought what we would do in terms of ending this program is that we would have you end it for us with Dream A Go, to give our listeners a taste of Gabrielle Stravelli, and that we're going to have you take it away. I want to thank you for joining me today, Gabrielle.
Thank
you for
having
me. So interesting. And for somebody who appreciates music but doesn't know the first thing about it, I will confess that when I was in elementary school, I played the trumpet, but it wasn't excellent. The neighbors signed a petition and handed it to my parents, because that was before our house had central air, and in the warm weather, the window would be open and I blast my trumpet. So I'm in awe and very appreciative and grateful for the Gabrielle Stravellis of the world.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining me today, and join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And Gabrielle, take it away with Dream A Go.
Thank you.
Feels like lifetimes since you've been gone, and I'm still not ready to move on. But maybe if I saw you, then I'd know it was only a dream. It was only a dream. Anytime I said I need you, in your arms I knew the strength of your embrace.